It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll get reactions to the ruling striking down Wisconsin's same-sex marriage ban from lawmakers on both sides of the aisle.
First, it's time for our monthly check-in with Discover Magazine editor Gemma Tarlag. Each month, she gives us a preview of the top stories in the latest issue of Discover.
The July-August issue hits newsstands tomorrow. The double issue is chock-full of cool science news. We've got a lot to talk about this afternoon, from dangerous ancient Roman toilets to a mystery at the center of the planet. Gemma Tarlak is senior associate editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back to the show.
Hey, great to be with you guys again.
Well, let's start. We talk politics on the show a lot, so let's look at this one. Midterm elections are coming up. You've got a story about a new voting system, some new technology. What's different about this?
Yeah, that's right. And I have to say, one of my favorite things about this story is the backstory to it. Mm. The county clerk in Austin, Texas, 3 years ago, got up at a computer security conference and challenged the people there at the conference to build her what she wanted. And they did. So it's called the Star Vote System. And there are a few different things about it. But to walk you through it very quickly, it's all about ensuring privacy, ensuring accuracy, and enabling easy verification by anyone, you, me, the politicians, the newspapers, etc. So you show up to vote, you get a token. Then, next step, you exchange that token for a unique number. That's basically your anonymous number to vote. You go and you vote, and then you verify, yes, this is how I want to vote. And then at home, or you know, in the newsroom or wherever you are, you can actually download all the encrypted votes. Privacy is still protected, but you can see the votes. Anyone can see them. Anyone can verify them, check the totals, etc. So it's kind of an exciting marriage of technology, privacy, and also just, hey, keeping them honest.
So you could go in and say, well, I'm 24601. Well, maybe not that number, but yeah, and that's how I voted.
So you can do that online, but also just anyone can look at the entire, you know, check the accuracy and verify the votes just in general. But yeah, there are a lot of different options to do it, and it's very transparent
and
while
how is
still
it,
protecting privacy.
How is it going over? Are people interested in implementing this thing?
Yeah, I think this is going to be kind of the test run for it. So we're going to see, but it looks really exciting, and I'm sure if it proves to be as easy and as private and as accurate as they're saying, I think it's going to catch on nationwide.
Well, Gemma, I'm a little confused. Have we ever had problem verifying votes in elections before?
I'd like to talk
a
little bit
about
the hanging chad. I can never tell when you're joking with me.
Oh, sorry. Too dry.
Okay.
Well, here's one that's fun to talk about. I don't know, fun to experience. I don't know. But we don't have to worry about it. Toilets in ancient Rome. You're fascinated by them, I hear, Gemma.
Not just ancient Rome. I will admit that when I've traveled, you know, pretty much around the world, and I've taken a lot of photos of toilets, and my friends think I have this weird thing about it. But to me, it's, you know, is there anything more universal than going to the bathroom? No. And everyone kind of has their different spin on it, you know, all different cultures, all different ages, et cetera. So we took a look at the toilet troubles of ancient Rome, which were really troublesome, trust me. I don't think I would want to try them out myself, basically because they were holes that, you know, were just lined up in these dark public areas, and they opened directly into the sewer channels. It was not uncommon to get bit by a rat while taking care of business. Also, methane could build up and explode. Not a good way to go. And there's like this whole subculture of gods and goddesses and, you know, special prayers and charms that people would have specifically for using the toilet in Rome.
And we see that in the archaeology of the Roman sewers and lavatories?
Yes. Now, here's kind of the funny thing. Believe it or not, there's this independent archaeologist who has made a career out of studying Roman toilets, and her name is Gemma as well.
Yeah.
I know.
It's a sign.
I know, right? Yeah, but Gemma Jansen has made her career out of studying the ancient toilets of Rome. Brave soul that she is.
Now, you said it wasn't just Rome. Do you see things like this elsewhere in the ancient world?
Yeah, well, you know, everywhere the Roman soldiers and the Roman army went, they took their roads and their toilets with them. So, you know, you do see a lot of similarities. For example, a few years ago, I was hiking Hadrian's Wall in northern England. There's a great Roman fort up there, and the toilets are still intact. And, yep, same idea.
I've seen here in the Midwest, people with log books or even entire joke books devoted largely to outhouse-related humor. What kind of things did the ancient Romans have? You mentioned gods and goddesses. Were they actually graffitiing prayers or tributes to gods and goddesses up on the walls?
Oh, not just graffiti. I mean, they had professional, beautiful mosaics. There's one of the goddess Fortuna, who is the goddess of luck, and she was a big presence in the toilet culture there. And they have a beautiful mosaic of her watching over a man getting things done.
So the Romans were great innovators. You'd think, you know, they built aqueducts and whatnot. You'd think they could come up with more than just praying for luck in the bathroom.
Right? And thank God we don't have to do that, right? Thank Fortuna we don't have to do that.
For sure. Well, it's hard to leave toilets behind.
But we must.
But we must. Let's go on to talk about another study. This one, there was a guy who was really interested in trying to figure out why he was a lousy singer. What did he do?
I love the scientific approach to the pain we've all experienced if we've ever gone to karaoke night, you know. Well, this guy, there's actually researchers who devote themselves to figuring out why people are terrible singers. And our writer went to them and said, help. They said basically bad singing involves a problem in one or more of three areas. The ability to keep time. Most of us have no problem with that. Something called note memory, which is both remembering the words to a song and how long to hold a specific note. And again, most of us have no problem with that. The big issue, pitch accuracy. And they find it's actually an issue of error correction in the brain. The fancy word for it is imitative deficit. And basically, if you sing the note wrong the first time, say you're aiming for a G and you hit an F sharp, right? Your brain just kind of imprints that F sharp. So every time you go for a G, even though you know you got to aim for that G and you know what it sounds like and you want to get there, your brain is like, no, let's do this one. So it's really hard to overcome. And actually, we have a bunch of really fun tests that you can try. We have the links to them right in the magazine. You can try to really see how much of an issue it is for you and whether you can kind of sing your way out of it.
And Gemma, you prepared a short solo to exhibit this for us, right?
Actually, it's an air guitar solo, and I'm doing it right now.
Oh, nice one.
Well, I would have thought my first guess would be it's in the vocal cords. You don't have the right musculature or something. That apparently
right.
is not the deal.
Yeah, and you know, for years in chorus, before I got kicked out for bad singing, they would make us do those exercises, you know, and it was specifically, oh, strengthen your vocal cords so you could hit the note better. That is all just, you know, no. It's your brain messing things up for you. Bad brain.
Is there a silver lining now that we sort of have a handle on what's happening when people can't sing? Can we correct it?
Well, there's the option of practice, practice, practice. But I just like the idea of having an official medical excuse. So, you know, next time I get booed off the stage doing a little Metallica at karaoke night, to be like, I'm sorry, I have imitative deficit.
Well, here's this one is a really hard science one that I found really interesting. We know so much about, you know, space, and we'll talk about exoplanets in a little bit. We know surprisingly little about what's going on just 7-8 miles and down below our feet inside the Earth. Why is it so hard to figure out what's down there?
Yeah, and you know, this is the kind of story that it's our cover story, by the way, for the issue. And it's the kind of story that you go into it thinking, oh, the Earth's core, they settled that years ago, didn't they? And then the more you read, the more you feel like a puny human who really has no idea what's going on. This is the center of our world, quite literally. We know very little about it. And that's for a number of reasons. I mean, it's really hard to get down there. Back during the Cold War, the Russians were committed to, yes, we will be the first to, you know, drill to the center of the Earth. And they had something called the Kola Super Deep Borehole out in the wilds of northwestern Russia. They were committed to it. They got about 7.5 miles down through the crust, and said, yeah, it's not working. And that's as far as they got. So that's like the deepest we've been in the crust. And you know what? That's not even halfway through the crust. And basically, if the Earth was an apple, we would not have even pierced the skin. So
wow.
There's a lot we simply can't access. We simply don't know. We kind of have to guess. And a lot of the previous theories, one by one, they've been proven wrong, including some of the most recent, that, you know, they actually realized if the Earth's center worked the way we thought it worked, our planet would pretty much explode. So they're trying to figure out, well, how does it work? And a lot of the issue has to do with how heat is conducted from the center of the Earth and, you know, exactly what's going on in the middle. And also, that's partly responsible for how our magnetic field is created and a lot of other aspects that make life on Earth possible. So it's really kind of a, you know, you think, oh, center of the Earth, okay, whatever, but then you realize it has all these implications, including, you know, enabling you and me to be alive.
Well, we're talking right now about some of the coolest news from the world of science with Discover Magazine editor Gemma Tarlak. We're continuing our discussion with Discover Magazine editor Gemma Tarlak about the top science stories in the latest issue, which hits newsstands tomorrow.
And Gemma, before we climb out of the Kola borehole in Siberia, it was interesting. Part of the reason they stopped digging was that at about 7 miles down, it got really hot and the crust started behaving differently. What happened?
Yes. And, you know, it's just not some place you want to be because we just don't have the technology to make it down there. And it actually, they had a lot of problems drilling in a straight line, even just because of how it was screwing up their tools and the hole itself. So it's a really interesting story, a little bit too complex for me to get into in a couple minutes, but definitely worth a read.
But the stone got plasticky and was filling in the hole as they dug?
Yes. That's why the hole kept kind of wiggling around and not going in a straight line.
So my backyard hole to China just isn't going to work with my shovel.
You should keep going on it.
Yeah,
then.
I will. Never give up.
Well, Gemma, there is also a feature in the new magazine about scientists who immerse themselves in 3D dimensional environments. And the deeper you go in this, it sounds like science fiction that we're involved in here. But this is happening. What's going on with this?
Well, you know, the more involved we get with research, the deeper we go, the more granular our study of variety of fields, whether it be hurricane or the human body, the deeper we go, the more data we're collecting, the more data we're amassing. And it's getting to the point where scientists are having a really hard time kind of keeping track of all the data, visualizing it, making those connections that are out there to further their research just in the data. So they're creating these enormous 3D environments, like you said. It's kind of like being in a 360 IMAX theater, and you're on a catwalk that kind of goes right through the middle, and it allows you to visualize the data. So they have people doing everything from looking at these compiled high-res images of the moon and being able to see different topographies that were not immediately apparent otherwise. They have other people who are just, other researchers are going into the circulatory system. They have a hurricane environment that allows you to see the storm using the data points that are collected and plotted. You're seeing the storm in a way you never could just staring at a computer screen. And it's allowing scientists to really flex their creativity and increase their understanding of what the data in front of them actually means, instead of looking at screen after screen after screen of numbers.
Well, is this at a point yet where, say, they could take images of a person, you know, with a medical problem and then get an inside view looking around for abnormalities?
You're thinking Fantastic Voyage, aren't you?
I am exactly, yes, thinking Fantastic Voyage without having to shrink anybody.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. It's Fantastic Voyage without the pesky shrinking issue. And that's basically what it is. And, you know, there are several different immersive environments around the country that are doing this, and they're all doing them in slightly different ways. So what each is able to do, it varies. It's, you know, one has a specialty in one area, another in another. But, yeah, I mean, that's where we're heading. You know, pretty soon the doctor, instead of just putting your X-ray up on that little light board in the exam room, they may have a X-ray of your lungs 200 feet high that they could pinpoint all these things they hadn't seen before.
Sounds a little invasive.
Yeah. Hey, Rob, let's take
a
stroll down
your
esophagus. Yeah.
Waiter, there's a doctor in my store. Never mind. Let's move on because there's so much cool stuff. This is a double issue of Discover. And what I want to talk about is the naming of exoplanets, which has created a bit of a controversy in the astronomy world. What's at issue here?
Yeah, and people get really passionate about this. There's an organization called the International Astronomical Union, and they've kind of been the ones to deal with naming new exoplanetary items out there, you know, moons and such, everything, the whole nine yards. And they come up with these really kind of dry, you know, HD 855-12b. Okay, that's all right, whatever. But there's this other organization, UINGO, that says, hey, let's all have the right to name something. So they're, you know, pushing the popular names. So, you know, pretty much you can, you know, name a planet whatever you want. And then there are nicknames for planets. For example, there's a planet orbited by two suns that, of course, everyone is calling Tatooine after.
Yeah,
Luke Skywalker's home. And then there's the question, okay, so we've got Mars, we've got Neptune. Those are all Greco-Roman mythology. What about using other world mythologies, whether it be Norse or Swahili? You know, let's branch out a little from Greco-Roman. So there's this huge controversy and discussion about what are we going to name all these exoplanets we're finding? And people feel really passionately on the topic.
Is the scientific community weighing in on the boring but functional, you know, series of letters and numbers for the most part?
Yeah. There's the series of letters and numbers. That's the way the International Astronomical Union does it. But there's also an argument for something called exoplanetary taxonomy, which is kind of similar to the Linnaean classification system we use for, you know, phylum, class, order, family, et cetera, all the way down to species. And so those are the kind of the number folks who want to go in one of those two directions. And then there are the people who are saying, no, let's name it after variety of gods. Or, hey, let's name it whatever we want. Let's name it Bob's Planet. Who cares? And so it's, you know, it's kind of the, I see it as kind of like the skiers versus the snowboarders, that debate, you know, that was raging a couple decades ago. Like, do we go down the slope the way our forefathers did, or do we play loud music and wear baggy pants? It's kind of the same approach.
And I suppose the more we know about the universe, the more of these exoplanets we're going to find, it might become impractical to name everything.
Well, there are thousands of them out there that we already know about, and they're finding more every month. So, yeah, we're going to run out of gods and goddesses real soon. And, you know, if I could get some speck of dust in the universe named after me, yeah, sure. I'm all for that.
But in a kind of serious note, do you capture the imagination of kids with a TT384B or with Osiris, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, but, you know, the question is, okay, do you capture the imagination of kids or do you reflect something about the actual planet? And that's, you know, if you go the taxonomic route, you're in the name itself is embedded kind of the location, the planet type, planet size, and everything. So it's kind of which way do you want to go? Do you want to, you know, appeal to the kids or kind of make it clear for researchers to have a way to organize these things?
One more topic before we get out of here. 20 things we didn't know about play. We don't have to get through all 20, but what kind of things do we take for granted when it comes to playtime?
Well, super quick, let's go. Let's start with human and end with bears. Humans, children will play anywhere. They have documented children playing in war zones and concentration camps. It's just such an innate part of us. And not just us. They did a study on wild brown bears in Alaska and found out, for reasons they're not quite sure, the more the bears played, the more likely they were to survive into adulthood. And they think it may give them a behavioral edge, but they think roughhousing and wrestling around, rolling in the mud, may actually expose them to more bacteria that strengthens their immune system. So all the different aspects of play are just fascinating, and we're just starting to understand what they are.
And not just bears, dolphin, and there were some strange insect that practiced having sex first or played at having sex. It does seem to have some kind of biological function.
Absolutely. You know, it's kind of training for adulthood in a lot of different ways.
Gemma, any play plan for this weekend?
Actually, I'm car shopping.
Oh, that sounds more like work.
I know. There's nothing fun about that, I got to say.
All right. We'll leave it there. Gemma, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Always great to be with you.
That was Gemma Tarlak, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine. She joins us each month to bring us up to date on some of the coolest, most interesting, or most playful topics from the worlds of science.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, our guest says climate change pollution is being exported to the developing world as the U.S. and other developed countries impose new regulations.
First, last Friday afternoon, U.S. District Court Judge Barbara Crabb ruled that Wisconsin's ban on same-sex marriage is unconstitutional. The ruling left it unclear whether or not same-sex marriages could begin taking place immediately, but within an hour and a half, weddings began at courthouses in Madison, Milwaukee, and spread elsewhere as well.
That night, State Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen filed an emergency motion to try to stop counties from issuing marriage licenses to same-sex couples, saying Crabb hadn't yet officially blocked Wisconsin's marriage ban. This morning, he asked for a stay on the ruling from a federal court in Chicago.
Although the future of the legal battle remains unclear, those in favor of and opposed to same-sex marriage have been sharing their reactions around the state. Right now, we're going to hear from two representatives from two perspectives from two Wisconsin legislators. First, we'll hear from Republican Senator Glenn Grothman from West Bend, and he'll be followed by Democratic United States Representative Mark Pocan from Wisconsin's 2nd District. Senator Grothman, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, glad to be on the show. I'm maybe not so glad given the topic, but always appreciate that you call me.
Well, I want to know what went through your mind when you first heard Judge Crabb's ruling last Friday.
Well, I'm not saying it's surprising because Justice Crabb in the past has shown that she has a dislike for anything based on religion, and she's, really doesn't care what the law says. You got to remember Justice Crabb a few years ago struck down the National Day of Prayer until we quickly had to turn around and get an appellate judge to overrule her. So if you don't want a day of prayer, something that governors or presidents have been declaring, probably throughout the history of the United States, it's not surprising if she would find a right to gay marriage in our Constitution, even though throughout most of our country's history, we didn't have gay marriage. Homosexuality was even illegal. So obviously it's a ridiculous ruling. There is no way the state of Wisconsin under our U.S. Constitution should be forced to issue marriage licenses to homosexual couples. But this is something we see from a lot of left-wing judges, and you can't be any more left-wing than this current judge.
And yet she said she doesn't condone the marriages that are taking place across Wisconsin. What do you make of that?
Well, she clearly wanted to have homosexual marriage, or she wouldn't have struck down a constitutional provision that was passed by the state legislature and passed by the voters. I mean, under normal circumstances, you give deference to state law. And again, you think how long this country's been around, and under our U.S. Constitution, how long we have not only not had homosexual marriage, we haven't even had legal homosexuality. So what really this decision means is that Judge Crabb on her own is in favor of homosexual marriage, and she ignores what the people who put together our Constitution wanted and just says willy-nilly, I find something in here that's going to force the state of Wisconsin to do this.
And there have been 11 county clerks who have gone ahead and issued marriage licenses in Wisconsin, the bulk of them being in Madison and Milwaukee, but elsewhere in the state as well. What do you make of that, given that we're in this period, a little bit of legal limbo right now?
Well, first of all, some of them may be confused and not know what they're supposed to do. But since Justice Crabb did not say that they should do this or did not overturn our constitutional amendment, these people are breaking the law, which is, again, unfortunate. But over time, we are having a more and more of an attack on Christianity in general in this nation. And it's a very sad thing for people such as me who always kind of viewed America as a special country. It's not a country in which, we're necessarily governed by the Bible, but our country was founded by many, many people for whom religion was very important, and they kind of looked America to be a city on a hill and, I think, a very, very religious country among its people. And now we have a situation in which our government is openly hostile to Christianity. And by trying to make homosexual marriage legal, we are sending a message to the young people that homosexuality is no big deal, which is really what I think this effort is about.
And I
on the
just
part of the atheistic left.
I want to jump in here since we're running short of time. Now, Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen has asked for a stay on the ruling that was not granted. What do you think? What would you like to see going forward in the courts?
Well, I think the courts should uphold Wisconsin's law. First of all, they should immediately reinstate Wisconsin's law, and secondly, I assume an appellate court will say Justice Crabb is wrong, just as an appellate court previously said Justice Crabb was wrong to strike down a National Day of Prayer. It would be nice if it meant anything for maybe even Governor Walker to call in the legislature and clarify what this meant, though I'm not going to hold my breath on that. But it is a very frustrating thing. We like to tell people they should respect the judiciary. But when you have a judiciary just make something up, I mean, our Constitution is over 200 years old. Nobody thought there was a right to so-called gay marriage from 1789 till about 8 years ago. Nobody would even thought of it.
And we're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. Senator Grossman, I appreciate you making the time to join us today.
Well, glad to be on the show.
We've been talking to Senator Glenn Grossman from West Bend. And now we're joined by United States Representative Mark Pocan from Wisconsin's 2nd District to hear his reaction to Friday's ruling. Representative Pocan, thanks for joining us.
Oh, glad to be here. Thank you.
So what was your immediate reaction when you heard Judge Crabb's ruling?
Well, you know, I think I was obviously very happy to hear that we finally were going to treat every single one of our citizens with respect and dignity and give them the liberty to live their lives like now 20 other states. Do. So it was good that we finally have been brought into that column of states that don't have discrimination when it comes to marriage. And I think, you know, I was down there at the City County Building in Madison on Saturday morning, and there was just a lot of celebration.
And what is your response to those who say that the courts are going against the wishes of Wisconsinites who voted to put the ban in place with 59% of the voters back in 2006?
Yeah, well, I mean, the U.S. Supreme Court made a decision that's obviously what's been the push of the dominoes on this and said that it would be illegal to discriminate. Therefore, you know, state after state after state, including places like Utah that are hardly known for being liberal progressive states, have made this decision to match up with the constitutionality at the federal level. So this is simply a judge recognizing what the U.S. Supreme Court said and making sure that marriage access is available for everyone without discrimination. So, you know, I think one of the arguments that we heard from the last person was, you know, because it's been around for a very, very long time, we should continue it. But I wouldn't argue because we had polio for a very, very long time, we should continue it if the society has changed and times have changed. And right now, a majority of people support marriage equality in Wisconsin. That should be what rules, according to the U.S. Constitution, the decision that was made. And I think some of these other arguments are really more political and rhetorical in nature.
The way that the law has been implemented or interpreted so far have been uneven across Wisconsin. We have some clerks granting licenses to same-sex couples, largely in Madison, Milwaukee, but elsewhere as well. What do you think about that action right now, given that, in general, there's still some gray area about how the law will be interpreted?
Well, I don't think there's gray area in that it is unconstitutional to have marriage discrimination. That's very clear in Judge Crabb's decision. Where she was less clear was whether or not you could start this immediately. So I think most county clerks have had people asking them for years and years and seen what's happened in all the other states around the country where the exact same sort of decision has happened have decided to start issuing the licenses. But I agree, there is some confusion. I think everyone agrees with, if you look at Judge Crabb's decision, while she's completely clear on the unconstitutionality, she wasn't as clear as the timing of when all of this can take place. So I'm glad that county clerks are moving forward and doing their jobs. But I agree, there is some, I think, confusion in how the final part of the decision was written.
Yeah, she said she'd wanted some rules in place, procedural rules about how it would be implemented. But you think it's okay that clerks are going ahead and issuing these licenses?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's to make it as simple, it's not exactly rocket science. If two people two men or two women come in, it's no different than if a man and a woman comes in to get the license. So to think that we need a special set of rules or something isn't necessarily, I mean, obviously most county clerks who started this started it because it was very easy to implement, and they're able to do it. So I think, you know, well, we'll have to see what becomes of this. We saw today that she didn't agree with the attorney general. Once again, he was wrong on his clarification of the law, because the Supreme Court does have the ultimate standing, and we are unconstitutional when we had the ban in place. So I'm glad that county clerks are kind of filling in where the void is, but I'm sure that we're probably going to have some additional legal proceedings based on how that decision is written.
Where do you expect to go? Where do you expect this law to go in the future, given that there are foreshadowings of the Supreme Court taking it up next term?
Yeah, I mean, there's no question. You know, it's not a question of if. It's a question of just when every single person, every single state in our country can get married to the person they love with the same respect and dignity we treat with everyone else. So that's clearly where it's at. That's clearly where public opinion is at. The fact that some people still want to hold on, a few because they truly believe in what they're saying, and a few more who see this as a nice political issue to take advantage of those people who believe that way. I've always said, I think this is about the last election cycle where those who decide to use hate as a political issue are going to be victorious, because we have seen society continue to change in this area, and people recognize that everyone should be treated similarly. And, you know, if someone really feels threatened by my husband and my marriage, if Senator Grossman is threatened and his marriage somehow by that, that's his problem, not necessarily mine, although I don't think Senator Grossman is married. But for someone who is, I don't think I'm challenging their marriage by my husband and I being married in Canada in 2006.
Well, let's talk about that. As co-chair of the LGBT Equality Caucus and a married gay man yourself, what's the personal meaning of Judge Crabb's ruling to you?
Well, I mean, it's very big, because it's finally having that recognition. You know, when we had that hateful amendment put in the state constitution in 2006, that same month, my husband had and I had planned for a while to get married in Toronto. But we had to leave the country to do it at the time, and some people have to leave the state to do it. I actually officiated a wedding earlier this year out here in Washington, D.C. for a couple from Wisconsin. And, you know, that's just not fair that that's how it should happen. And I think the fact that we've seen what the Supreme Court said and what states are doing, you know, it's a really positive sign. However, you know, I hate to dampen the joy we have, but, you know, there's still a lot of situations where people in a lot of states can still be fired simply for being gay or lesbian. There's a lot of bullying in schools. There's a lot more we have to do, but this is a really big thing. And right now we're celebrating this and just making sure that it's implemented in Wisconsin, because, you know, we were the first state in the country to have a non-discrimination clause when it comes to being gay or lesbian. It's good that at least we're in the first half of states, I think, doing marriage equality.
Representative Pocan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely.
We've been speaking with United States Representative Mark Pocan from Wisconsin's 2nd District. Earlier, we heard from Wisconsin State Senator Glenn Grothman from West Bend. They've been weighing in on Friday's ruling that Wisconsin's same-sex marriage ban is unconstitutional. As we've heard on the show over the last week, new suggested guidelines from the EPA would require power plants to lower carbon emission levels. The goal in part is to reduce climate change pollutants.
But our next guest says that as stricter regulations on the use of fossil fuels are on the rise in the U.S. and other developed countries, and demand may be slowing down, energy companies are shifting their sales efforts to the developing world.
Michael Clare joins us now. He's professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College and the author most recently of The Race for What's Left. Michael, welcome to the show.
Always a pleasure to join you in Wisconsin.
Well, Michael, in a recent piece you wrote, you compare fossil fuels today with tobacco a couple of decades back and the strategies that tobacco used to keep their profits moving. What do they have in common?
What they have in common is a desire to perpetuate their profits of selling fossil fuels no matter what, and with increasing regulation in the United States, first on tobacco and now on fossil fuels, carbon products, these companies are looking to the developing world as a market to make up the loss that they may face in the developed countries. So just as tobacco targeted China and other developing countries when smoking became more difficult in the United States, now the fossil fuel companies are targeting China, India, and other developing countries that want energy and are less concerned about the environmental consequences.
Well, what kind of impact can we expect to see, both in those countries and globally, if fossil fuel consumption rises in the developing world?
Well, it's very clear that there will be an increase in carbon dioxide emissions, greenhouse gases, and the pace of climate change, of warming, will increase for years and years to come. So when President Obama, I support what he's doing, is cutting back on coal consumption in this country, if we then ship our surplus coal to China, which is what the coal companies want to do, there'll be just as much as emissions as before. There'll be no reduction in carbon emissions.
And the companies have been pretty transparent, at least based on some of what you quote, about wanting to shift some of the business overseas to some of these countries like China and India, who are in the developing end of things. And they've said, well, these are people who have energy need, and it's in a sense a humanitarian goal to provide them with energy. What would you say to that?
That's what they say. They say that there are many people in the developing world who want more energy. They want cars, they want air conditioners, they want basic sources of electricity, and so on, and that's certainly the case. And they say that it's a humanitarian mission to help provide those people with energy. Well, that may be so, but all of the studies done by international scientific bodies and U.S. government show that poor people in the developing world will be the principal victims of climate change, that people in those countries are more exposed to flooding, to drought, to food scarcity, and other natural disasters as the climate the emissions increase and climate change gains momentum.
Would you expect to see those countries begin to regulate more rigorously the way, say, the United States and other countries are doing?
They talk that way, but they're torn because they have high developmental goals. They want to increase electricity production. They want to increase manufacturing. And to do that, they want a lot of energy quickly. And the cheapest, easiest way to increase production, energy production, is by burning coal. So they are putting their developmental goals ahead of their long-term security.
And do you expect to see health issues as well?
Oh, my gosh, yes. Anybody who has either traveled to China in recent years or has followed in the news knows very well that the atmospheric conditions are horrendous, that people could barely breathe in a lot of those cities because of their reliance on coal, the heavy reliance on coal. And so the health effects are astonishing. Millions of people suffering from smog-related illnesses.
What do you see as the alternative for these countries? They seem to have a demand for fuel, for energy. They can't stop using fossil fuels, can they?
I think they can. I mean, in the short term, of course, they've made an investment in coal plants. China and India, Turkey, Indonesia, other rapidly developing countries. But it's in their very best interests to move as rapidly as possible to renewable sources of energy, both from a health perspective, a national security perspective, and ultimately economically, because they won't need to import so much energy if they could rely on domestic renewable fuels. And they want to do that, but they need help. They don't have the technology yet fully developed, although they're moving that way, and they need support from the developed countries to rapidly accelerate the introduction of renewable sources of energy.
And looking at the big picture for a moment, which is the amelioration of climate change, if we have the developing world amping up their use of fossil fuels, does that mean that the countries who are working to scale it back, you know, they'll sort of cancel each other out and we'll be at a stalemate?
Oh, I'm afraid that's so, because it doesn't matter where the carbon emissions originate. They all go up into the outer atmosphere and settle there and trap heat, causing climate change. So So even if we in this country managed to reduce our carbon emissions under President Obama's plan, if we continue to export fossil fuels to other countries or stand by when they increase their reliance on fossil fuels, we're going to suffer just as much as we would otherwise.
Michael, we'll leave it there. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure always.
That was Michael Clare, professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College and the author of The Race for What's Left.